First of all, the series for the year is dedicated by Michael and Ruthie Mammon. This particular session is also dedicated with the following gifts from the Day of Giving in July, from Arlene and John Anthony, from Ari and Lauren Berman, and from Rabbi Martin and Marilyn Berman. And I spoke to Rob today, and he's dedicating the learning as well tonight in memory of his father. For those who were not aware, his father passed away. Rob's currently sitting Shiva. And his father's Hebrew name is Avram ben Menachem Halevi, Zichrono Livracha. So his neshama should have an aliyah, and the family should have nechama. We started the story last time of this visit by the tribe of Dan. We didn't actually read the visit yet. We just introduced the fact that Dan has a portion of land which, based on the map that I showed you, is right near Gaza. And of course, we knew it was there anyway because we know that Shimshon was between Yehuda and Dan and fighting with the Plishtim on his border. So we already knew that that's where Dan had their land. Nonetheless, we find here that Dan gets land in the way north, at the top of the Jordan River, the top of the Yarden. We noted that this may fit Moshe's bracha, which describes Dan as Yizanek min HaBashan, spurting forth from the Bashan. And we noted as well that in Yehoshua, in chapter 19, it already described Dan conquering an area north in Israel, a place called in Yehoshua, we said it was actually called one thing. We're going to see this week that it's called something else in Shoftim. Here it's going to be called, I think, Leshem, and there it's Laish, or am I reversing it? Here it's going to be called Laish. I did reverse it. Here it's called Laish. In Yehoshua, it's called Leshem. So we said that there are two main schools of thought regarding Dan's motivation. The main schools of thought are either they didn't have enough land in their portion. They were a large shevet, a large tribe, second biggest to Yehuda at the end of the period when the Jews are in the wilderness. Or alternatively, they couldn't conquer the eastern part of their portion of land. And then there was this other idea that Abarbanel and Malbim brought, that maybe their land was far from others, which we said is a little hard to work with. So they decide, we're going to get this other land. And then the other question that we asked, that we ended with, was, so are they supposed to take this Laish Leshem territory? And Radak first brought the view that said, this is part of their goral, this is part of their portion, and Rashi seems to support this as well. It fits with Moshe's bracha as well. Alternatively, though, Radak brought another view that says, no, this wasn't part of the distributed land at all. In fact, Rabbi David Altshuler, Mitzudat David, said it isn't Israel at all. Which makes sense, because if you take the view, which many hold, that this land is not only way up north, but also east of the Yarden, it's odd that Dan was not listed as one of the tribes that gets land on the other side of the Yarden. So that would seem to support this. So the last bit of introduction, and then we can actually see what happens in our story, is the question of how to read Dan's conquest of this land. What are we supposed to make of it? Is it a good thing? Is it a bad thing? How do we understand it based on everything that we've said? Absolutely. Absolutely. One of the arguments for putting this in the beginning of the history of the Shoftim was to say it's very odd to see a conquest taking place centuries in. Now you decided you didn't have enough land? Although it could be. I mean, it could be. Over the centuries, you grow, and now you need more space. So it's not unthinkable. Right.
So they look for an easier target.
Right. I mean, you could certainly read this story as a Parav story. And it certainly helps if it's in the beginning of that period. They needed land. They needed more land. They couldn't conquer their land. Maybe Laish slash Leshem is supposed to be theirs. So you could read it that way for sure. Or you could read it in a more troubling way. They didn't make the effort to settle their own portion. And instead, they went for easy pickings elsewhere. Especially if this land is outside of Israel. Take a look at source number one, please. I brought you a Medrash in the Sifri. For those who don't read Toronto Torah every week, you should. This past week, we talked about, it was chapter 10 in Shmuel Bet, was the chapter, I should explain. We have a chapter, Journey Through Tanakh. We've been going every week, a chapter of Tanakh. So we're now in Shmuel Bet, and last week was Perek Yud. I happen to have written the column. And in that Perek, we find David accidentally go to war against Aram. The story there is that the king of Ammon passes away. David sends a condolence message to the son of the king of Ammon, now the new king of Ammon. However, the son's counselors say David is not sending you a nice condolence message. He actually has sent spies to check out the land for an invasion. And so they humiliate David's emissaries, and David says this is an act of war. And he goes to war against them, and then Aram comes to help Ammon. And David ends up with a war against Aram, and he ends up conquering Aram. And the Gemara says, and the Rambam writes, that Aram doesn't quite become part of Israel. Aram is in what is today Syria, and maybe a little further east. So if you take a look at source number one, you find an important midrash on this issue. Hashem says to the Jews, Kol ha'makom asher tidroch kaf raglechem bo, lachem yehyeh. Wherever you walk will be yours. So the Midrash says, Matam lomar kol ha'makom asher tidroch. What is the message here of that sentence? Wherever you walk, that will be for you. Amar lehem, Hashem told them, Kol makom shetich b'shu, any place you conquer, chutz mimekamos ha'elu, aside from this land of Israel, harei yushalachem, will be yours. In other words, Hashem already promised us we're getting the land of Israel. This pasuk was to say, when the Jews conquer land elsewhere, that also becomes part of Israel. So the Midrash asks, O rishus bi'adam lichbosh chutz la'aretz ad shel yichbashu eretz Yisrael? So wait, is there permission for them now? They can go conquer lands outside of Israel before they take Israel proper? No. Talmud Lomar, if you look at the text there in Devarim chapter 11, it says first, Virishtem goyim gedolim batzlam ikem. First it says you're going to conquer the nations of the land. And then afterwards, wherever you go, you will get. You don't have the right, as the Midrash continues, to leave Israel filled with idolatry and the Canaanim, while you go conquer land somewhere else. That's the message of the Sifri. And this is brought as halacha in the Rambam in Hilchos Truma, the laws of tithing Truma. So the message is you're not supposed to do outside conquest before you settle the land. What that means is that the people of Dan are guilty of an element of what looks like greed, which matches up well within the story, right? Because this is a story of greed. Who is greedy so far in this story? Explicitly, we have one who's explicitly greedy and one who's implicitly greedy. Uh-oh.
Micha's mother.
Right. She's the one who is implicitly greedy because she promises the 1,100 and she only actually uses 200. So we had different explanations for why that's true. But one explanation is that she says, I don't need to spend all 1,100. I can get away with spending just 200 out of that and keep, you know, the other 900 for myself. How about, though, the Levi? Right? The Levi who hires himself out for a change of clothing and food and 200 and what was it? 10 silver coins a year. You know, this little nothing. The
greater survival.
So If you say he really needs it to survive, then I accept what you're saying. But the fact that he's willing to become a servant for the idol isn't a good look. We don't usually say that that warrants doing it for the sake of survival. We're going to come back to that point at the end of the story, because there's more to be said about that. It looks like greed to me. And then the other is the people of Beit Lechem, who didn't support the Levi. Right? The fact that the Levi is walking because he's not able to find, find subsistence there is a message as well. So is this a positive story or is it a negative story? Well, the answer really is in the beginning of chapter 18. Right? Because what do? When this story starts, the beginning of the chapter says, "Bayamim ha'hem," in those days, "Ein melech b'Yisrael," there was no king in Israel. "Uvayamim ha'hem," and in those days, "Shevet hadanim mevakesh lo nachala l'sheves," the tribe of Dan is looking for a portion to settle. As we said, because they have not settled their portion. When you say there is no king, and that's when this happened, that's a tip-off. This is not a power of story. They're doing something that they shouldn't be doing. You follow? However, it doesn't have to be the way I'm reading it. That does not have to be the way that I am reading it. Abarbanel reads it this way. Abarbanel reads it the way that I just said. If you take a look at Abarbanel in source number 3, I'm going to come back to number 2. But Abarbanel says, "V'hayara uisha b'nei Dan yichbishu es eretz nachal asam." The right thing to do would have been for them to capture their portion. But not to do what they do. They're not supposed to leave the bounds of their portion in order to take land that doesn't belong to them. They did this. You didn't have a king. You didn't have a ruler to tell them what to do. And therefore, they weren't afraid of anybody. Now, Abarbanel, remember, thinks this is either when Shimshon's in jail, therefore there's no leader, or it's the very early days after Yoshua passes away, before you've established the structure with the Shoftim. So that's one way to take it. What they did wrong is going to take this land. That's not what they were supposed to do. They were supposed to take their own. However, two other approaches to what they were doing wrong, potentially. One from Malbim. Malbim says, you're missing the main part of the story here. It's the idolatry, pal. He says, take a look at source number 2. Gama sipur sheyavo po, hayasi baso mitzad shein melech otzer ba'am. The story that evolves here is because there is no leader. Shem hayalem melech lo hayashevit miyisrael obdim avodazara. If you had a king, they wouldn't have worshipped idolatry. He says, that's what we're picking on. It's not the conquest. It's the statue. Valid. And you'll see why he says it as we go through the chapter, because that really does become a focus of the chapter. And then the third view, Rav David Altshuler, the Mitzudat David, in source number 4, says, Ki im haya melech, Hayahu lochem milchamos ha'amim kol amo velo shevet levad. Because if there were a king, the king would have brought the entire nation out to war. Why is Dan doing this alone? That's what it means, there's no king in Israel. Because Dan has to go off and do this himself. If you had a king, there would have been a central authority. So what this means is, effectively, you can read the story as pariv in terms of conquest, and say that the condemnation of there is no king is a reference to the idolatry or a reference to the fact that they have to fight alone. Or you read it as a condemnation of the conquest, like Abarbanel does, saying they weren't taking their own land, they were going beyond their land at a time when it was not yet appropriate.
Story of actually sent for people to help, and they didn't show up.
Correct.
You know, with the king, it doesn't work that way, or a shofet. And we know that with the kings of Israel, they caused the people to do Avodah Zarah.
Correct. Correct. Meaning, what we're presenting here is an ideal. There's no king, therefore these things happen, and a king is supposed to prevent that. In practice, it's a bust. That's, you're 100% right. In practice, they were not able to get unity. If anything, we got splits among the, in the kingdom. And we certainly ended up with idolatry, and not only in Yisrael, but often in Yehuda as well. Not to the scale, you know, and extent of Yisrael, but you certainly had it in Yehuda too. So yes. Okay. So now we're going to see the actual story. Take a look, please. We just did Pasuk Aleph. Let's go through Pasuk Bet. Sentence 2 through 6. Vayishlechu v'nei dami mishpachtam chamisha anashim miktzosam. So the people of Dan sent from among their families 5 men miktzosam. Abar Benel explains that language. He says, first of all, mishpachtam, from their families. He says, meaning from different families, like with the spies, where you had one from each tribe. So you had leading families, and it was one from each family. Mikitzosam means from those on the edge, meaning the leaders. Just like with the Meraglim, where you had the Nisim, you had leaders go, so to here, they have leaders. Anashim b'nei chayil, men of substance. Mit Tzara u'me Eshtaol. Tzara and Eshtaol, of course, were Shimshon's cities. L'ragel es ha'aretz u'lochokra. To spy out the land, to do research. Vayomru aleim, and they said to him, L'chu chikru es ha'aretz. Go look at the land. Vayavau Har Ephraim ad Beis Micha. They come to Har Ephraim, to the house of Micha. Vayalinu Sham. And they stayed there. They stayed in the house of Micha. This is what we mentioned already, I think, last week, the week before, that Micha is hospitable. Micha accepts people in, and that was his saving trait. Was the fact that he's at least hospitable. Yeah, there may be some Avodah Zarah. We don't like that. Nonetheless, he at least welcomes people in. When you get to the next story, Pilegesh Begiva, they don't even have that. Okay. So, Pasuk Gimel. Hema im Beis Micha. They're in the house of Micha. Vehema hikiru es kol hanar halevi. And they recognized the voice of this Levi. Vayasuru sham, and they went over there. Vayomru lo, and they said to him, Mi heviacha halom, umata ose baze, umalacha fo. That's an interesting set of questions. Someone with an English translation, could you translate that, the questions they asked? Anybody? Someone's got to have English here.
Who brought you here, and what are you doing in this place? And what do you have here?
Right. Okay. So they take me as who, right? Me doesn't have to be who. Gerald, you had unmuted. Do you have a different translation?
Just on the last question, it's what profit have you here?
What profit have you here? How are you managing here? What's your gig? Okay. So the first question, who brought you here? Your second question is, sorry, I just lost the place. Ma'ata oseh bazeh, what are you doing here? Abarbanel says this question is not a fact question. What are you doing here? Rather, it's, what are you doing here? Like, why are you in a house of idolatry? A Levi doesn't belong in a place like this. And then, what's your profit, or, you know, what exactly is there for you here? How are you being supported here? Interesting set of questions. There's more to be said about this set of questions, but first let's see his answer. Vayomer aleihem, he says to them, Kazo v'chaze asali Micha, Micha has done such and such for me. Vayiskereni, he hired me. V'ehilo lechohen, and I am a kohen for him. So Abarbanel says, he answers the three questions, right? Micha brought me here. That answers the first question of who brought you here. Micha is paying me. That answers the third question of where your profit is. What are you doing here? What are you doing here, but what are you getting out of being here? And I act as a Kohen. And that's why I'm here with this idol. Now, a couple of notes. First of all, take a look, please, at your sheet at source number 5. This is from the Gemara in Bava Basra, which we've already started to quote, and we are going to have to spend a lot more time with by the end of this story. That's the one that talks about who this Levi is. So look at this. If you were to read the words carefully that they asked him, you would already possibly see this. Amrulo, they said to him, Lav mi Moshe ka'asis, are you not a descendant of Moshe? Dichsiv bei al tikrav halom, of whom it says, don't come near. This is talking about the snat, the burning bush, al tikrav halom. So their first question is, mi haviacha halom. It's an unusual word for it to show up there, but we're not done. They continue to say, lav mi Moshe ka'asis, aren't you from Moshe? Dichsiv bei maze biyadecha. Moshe, Hashem says to him at the burning bush, Maze biyadecha, what is in your hand? And it's a staff, right? So they said to him, Ma ta oseh bazeh? What are you doing with zeh? Hashem said to Moshe, what is zeh in your hand? And further, Lav mi Moshe ka'asis, do you not come from Moshe? Dichsebe ve'ata po amodi madi. Hashem said to Moshe, you stand here with me. Right, when Moshe asks Hashem to explain how the universe works, so he says, "V'ata po amodi madi." But so, "Malacha fo," what are you doing, po? You're a descendant of Moshe who stood po with God. Te'asa kohen l'avodah zarah. How in the world do you end up as a priest for idolatry? That's the Gemara's read of this set of questions. As the Maharsha notes on that Gemara, the Medrash is spurred by the fact that they ask these three questions, which all seem to be somewhat redundant. How much difference is there between who brought you here, what are you doing here, how are you making money here? There isn't much difference. Answer: you're right, there isn't much difference. It's really it's really meant to hint to me something else, which is hinting to Moshe as this man's ancestor. But I think there's also an element of a progression going on in his answers. He says, Micha brought me here. Micha pays me. I act as a Kohen. This reminds me of the progression that the Malbim identified when the Levi was first recruited. Right? First, Micha hosted me. Then he hired me. And then I became a Kohen. I was lured in bit by bit to do this. And that's effectively answering what they wanted to know. So right now what we see is they pick him out of a crowd, so to speak. There's no crowd, but they identify him. They ask him why and who and what's going on here. And he says, I'm here. He's supporting me and I'm working as a Kohen for him. A couple of more psukim, and then I want to come back to a key question, which I know you have to be wondering about. Pasuk hey. Sentence 5. Vayom rulo, they said to him, Sha'al na belo, and now I don't know how to say this word, either belo him or belo kim. They say to him, inquire now of something, God uppercase G or God lowercase G. Vinei da'ah, and then we'll know. Hasatzliach darkeinu asher anachnu ochim aleha. Will we succeed on this path that we're going on? You know, we're on this dangerous mission. We're going up north to look for land for our tribe. Who knows what we're going to encounter along the way? Do us a favor. Inquire of your trafim. We want to know whether we're going to succeed. Vayomer lehem hakohen lechule shalom, and the kohen says to them, "Go to peace," which is a term that we use, a phrase that we use when things are going to go well, right? The Gemara in Brachos says you say to people lech lishalom, not lech bishalom. Lech bishalom is bad; it bodes poorly. The lech lishalom is positive. Nochach Hashem darkechem asher telchu ba, your path is opposite God. This path you're going to walk in a good way. Meaning, God's is on your side. Okay, first of all, what question has to come up from the opening few psukim here? What question has to bother everybody?
Why are they staying at Micha's house in the first place?
Well, Micha's given them a place to stay. They need some place to stay on their way. It's far from Dan all the way up north. Yeah. What does that mean? They recognized his voice. So that's well, that. Yeah.
It could be based on the service he was doing.
Meaning?
He was doing avodah. So based on the avodah he was doing, they recognized it was a kohen that was doing it, or it's a descendant of Moshe, someone famous.
Mm-hmm. Could be. We're gonna have to see. We have to look at a couple of ideas. What else is odd here or forces us to ask a question in the latter two psukim?
If they're asking him to consult with Trofim, how is it that leaders of a Shevet would be asking someone to...
Yeah, the leaders of Dan, are they idolatrous? Is that really where this is going? So, in terms of how they recognized him, Abarbanel is sort of along the lines of where Howie sounded like he was going at one point. Abarbanel says either he was singing in front of the idol, or he was speaking, but somehow they recognize that as a Levi trait or even of him specifically, like he's a known guy. Professor Kaufman offers the idea that Leviam might have had a particular speaking style, which is an interesting idea. I have no idea where he gets that from. But the Malbim says, no, he's a celebrity. He's from Moshe, right? That's one of the things that we've already hinted at, which we have to still walk through the Gemara on. He's from Moshe. Well, Moshe is from the family of Kehat, right? We know that the Leviam have three branches. Levi has three sons, Gershon, Kehat, and Merari. Kehat has four sons, Amram, Yitzhar, Chevron, and Uziel, and Moshe is from Amram. So Moshe is from Amram, that means Moshe is from Kehat. Well, back in Yehoshua chapter 21, we learned that the tribe of the clan of Kehat camps with cities, or lives in cities, that are in the area of Ephraim, Menashe, and Dan. So he is from a family, says the Malbim, that lived in Dan. And therefore they knew his voice. Take a look at source number 6. I'll just read out my translation quickly. Since this Levi was from Kehat, from Moshe's descendants, as per Bava Basra, which we've been reading part of, and the cities of the Levite family of Kehat were among Ephraim, Dan, and half of Menashe, this Levi was a product of a Levite city in Dan, and so they knew him. Small town. That's why they are going north, right? Because it's a small town. So that fits really well, because then their progression from recognizing him to asking, what are you doing here, makes sense. We know you. He spent some time in Beit Lechem Yehuda, not making a living, but he's originally from their area. So they say to him, ask of your trafim. So the Mefarshim, the commentators here, generally believe that Dan is not idolatrous. Radak notes that the Gemara seems to think that they are idolatrous, but the commentators here generally assume that they are not idolatrous. We find similar distinctions elsewhere in Navi, where the Gemara will have one take on a story, and the commentators, the traditional commentators, will take it in a very different way. Example, in Shmuel Aleph, when Shmuel warns the nation of all the powers of a king, So there's a debate as to whether he's serious, like kings can really do that, or whether he's just trying to intimidate them. You know, if you get a king, your kings are going to do terrible things to you. And the commentators to it generally assume that Shmuel is just threatening them. He's saying to them, you know, kings are bad guys, and they're going to do terrible things to you. But the Gemara has a debate and seems to come out with the view that, no, Shmuel is saying this is what kings are able to do. It's a debate in the Gemara there, but that seems to be the conclusion. So similarly here, the Gemara seems to think, yeah, the people of Dan are idolatrous. We saw this Gemara already last week. It's the Gemara that says that that every time you see the name of God here, other than one, it's a reference to idolatry. So when they say Sha'alna, they're saying Sha'alna Be'elohim, ask of the idol. That's the Gemara's take. But the commentators disagree. Take a look, please, at source number 7, where Rashi says it's not Avodah Zarah. It doesn't mean it's a good thing. But Rashi says it's betrafim shemedabrim al yedei mechashvut, or mechashifot, I suppose. Now, by mechashvut, they're trying to channel magical forces. Malbim has that as well. Or you have Radak, who says to you in source number 8 that they believe that they are actually approaching God. He says, Lo hayazeha ephod el l'shem avodas gilulim asui b'dmut ephod. He says the ephod was idolatrous. The ephod itself is naturally idolatrous. But it was made, modeled on the ephod of the Kohen Gadol, so that it would look like a frum ephod, so to speak. V'hatrafim hayu sho'alim b'hem l'das ha'asidos. They're asking of the trafim because they want to know the future. There is no portion of God in this. It is idolatrous. But they thought that they were asking of God. So Rashi, Malbim, Radak believe that these people are actually approaching Hashem, or they think that they are approaching Hashem. And ditto Abar ben Elon, source number 9. I'm just going to read out my English translation in the interest of time. They thought that this statue was made at a time and in a way such that it could draw down the influence and spirituality upon the one who served before it, informing of that which would happen in the future. They didn't think it was Avodah Zarah. They thought it's some kind of a talisman of sorts. And there was no portion of God in this, but the Danites thought that inquiring of these Trafim was in... I'm sorry, I jumped back. And they thought that this message would be from God, but via this intermediary. That's what they thought was going on. And Abarbanel notes that the Gemara disagrees. However, he says, yeah, but Targum Yonatan is on my side, so I'm okay with it. So, two different views. The Mefarshim believe, as a general rule, that the people of Dan were not idolatrous. They were just suckered, at most. Whereas the Gemara thinks, no, this is actually a conspiracy of idolatry. The last bit on this, in Pasuk Vav, in sentence 6, the answer is, Nochach Hashem darkechem asher telchu ba, the path that you are going to walk is opposite God, not opposite in a bad way. The Rashi says that he's saying the path is known before God. Don't worry about magic. But Radak and Malbim say, he's saying, God is going to help you. God is going to assist you. So the upshot of all of this, of what we said last week and what we said this week, and for those who just joined, I'm guessing that you missed the email and the reminder, but we started at 7 because of the Shavuot tone. So you'll get the summary right now, though. We saw Dan's unhappiness with their land, whether it's a consequence of not having enough land or they don't want to bother conquering their land. However you read that, we read their venture north. We now have a pagan interaction for them with Micha, and there is no king. Whether that's a statement of, and therefore this move by Dan is inappropriate, or whether it's Dan shouldn't be alone, but there's no king to get everybody to go with them, or whether it's a statement that this Avodah Zarah is a function of the lack of a king. However you read it, Dan is on their way. And so where the Perek is going to go next is that Dan is going to do reconnaissance in this place called Laish slash Leshem. Again, Leshem and Yehoshua, Laish here. They're going to get a good report that they can do whatever they want. And then they're going to come back through the area, and they're going to come away with more than they entered with. We'll have to see that, God willing, next week. Questions and comments on this? Yeah, Howie.
Okay. I don't know enough of Tana, but the name Yud-Kei-Vav-Kei, is that also used for Avodah Zarah versus Elohim?
Right. So we asked that question earlier in the parak, right?
Right. And there he said it may have been Yud-Kei-Vav-Kei was the actual God.
Correct. So Rashi takes that view here as well. I was speeding through a little bit at the end, but Rashi says what he's trying to tell them is this magic is nothing. It is all known before God, meaning the real God, and all of this magic is actually nothing. Don't bother trying to consult it. Rashi is taking the view that Micha starts out being a servant of God, until he gets drawn into idolatry. Rashi's in the camp that what will ultimately evolve is idolatry. He's not in the Ralbag camp who says, actually, Micha is a syncretist from day one until the end. Rashi understands that this fellow is actually not into idolatry yet. He's just playing a part. But he actually is saying, yeah, the magic is nothing. So Hashem meaning God. Good. Other comments, questions? Okay. Then, God willing, next week we will have a full time, and I don't know if we'll finish the story entirely. We might finish the story entirely, but we'll definitely have to spend a good chunk of time on the identity of this Levi and why the Gemara thinks it's Moshe's grandson. So whether that's next week or the week after, we'll have to see before we move into Pilegesh Begiva. And that's its own unique nightmare. Okay, so if anyone wants to stay on for the Shavuot Tone session, that starts in this Zoom room at 8 o'clock. Otherwise, I will see you at another shir.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Rabbi.